evening and welcome to Building Bridges, your community and labor report. I'm Ken Nash, and Mimi will be back next week. Later on the show, Paul Krugman, New York Times columnist and author of The Great Unraveling, Losing Our Way in the New Century. But first,
this is a Building Bridges, your community and labor report special. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash.
Tragic floods in Bangladesh have killed 1,600 people and left more than 2 million homeless. More than half of the capital city, Dhaka, is underwater, and the situation is getting worse as the water continues to rise.
The already depressed areas where the masses of garment workers reside have been the hardest hit. The garment workers are forced to live in areas below the flood levels since there is nowhere else that is affordable to them. The workers' homes are under 2 feet of polluted muck of sewage, mud and filth.
The flood has polluted all sources of drinking water. The smell is overwhelming and sickening. 50% of the garment factories have been forced to shut down, and hundreds of thousands are out of work. Medicine is in short supply, and diarrhea is rampant, especially among the workers' children. In Dhaka alone, over 500,000 garment workers have lost their homes and most of their few possessions. 85% of the garment workers are women and children.
Both the National Garment Workers Federation and the Bangladesh Center for Workers' Solidarity are doing all they can to help the flood victims. Already hundreds of workers are crowding into their tiny offices, desperately seeking help, even if it's just a bowl of rice and a bottle of clean water.
Building Bridges recently spoke with Barbara Briggs and Charlie Kernigan from the National Labor Committee, which has a long history of fighting on behalf of the Bangladeshi garment workers for decent working conditions.
Over 500,000 garment workers just in Dhaka have been affected by this flood, and our partners in Bangladesh say the workers are double affected because they're so poor. They live in the poorest neighborhoods, and that's the low-lying area that's been flooded. So literally some 500,000 or close to that have been flooded out of their homes. Their kids are sick, and also many of the garment factories have shut down, so they're not working, so they have no assistance. So it's just a horrific situation.
Makes it unbearable. If you've gone into these workers' neighborhoods, of course, like Barbara said, they're in the poorest areas of Dhaka. They're in the low-lying areas, so they flood the worst. The houses they live in are these flimsy one-room huts, like maybe 10-foot by 12-foot, put together with thatch, scraps of wood, scraps of metal. Basically, the workers live in these one-room huts, and they make a wooden platform about a foot or a foot and a half off the ground. That's what they sleep on, just sleep on the wood like that. And in the past, when the monsoons have come, the rains have come, the water will come right into the houses. And many of the workers will be sleeping like an inch above the water, 2 inches above the water. This time, this is the worst flood in Bangladesh's history, this time the water is 2 foot to 6 foot in the workers' homes. It's demolished many of the homes. And what happens in a city like Dhaka, this is a city with very poor garbage collection. It's all outhouses and latrines. It's water pumps. It's in some areas of Dhaka, it's almost like medieval. There's like open sewage pits down the sidewalks of the streets. When the flood came, everything mixed together. The sewage, the garbage, dead animals. It's an intolerable, filthy, stinking muck, and the people are living right in that. And in fact, the water is pumped water. It's from a hand pump, and the sewage has just inundated and contaminated everything. Many of the pumps are underwater. So you have people, you have, like Barbara said, the 500,000 garment workers, along with millions of other people, no access to clean drinking water. So sickness is spreading. There's outbreak of diarrhea, fever, malnutrition, vomiting. It's incredibly tragic. People have nothing. I mean, you know, these workers have lost their homes, their clothing, the little food they had, their money.
They have no access to clean water, no access to clean food. So our partners now in Bangladesh are basically going all out to try to do relief work with these garment workers who are already amongst the poorest of the poor, and now they have no clean water, and their kids are sick, And experts say the worst is yet to come, because even if there's sort of an initial, you know, flee your home, they're going to have to go back and drink out of those same contaminated wells. And there's not enough water purification tablets, and they're not getting distributed fast enough.
Are there any international relief efforts underway? And if there were, is the government of Bangladesh to be trusted to do what is right with that?
They're just beginning just now, and they're not enough. And they're not getting out to the very poorest people fast enough.
Even if the workers and the women, even if they had to drink this filthy, miserable sewage water, and they had some pills to control the worst of the diseases that come out of that water, so far those tablets, those water purification tablets, have reached less than 3% of the people. So you have 97% of the people drinking this filth. It's all they have. And so, you know, the government is poor, it's broken. Of course, it's a very corrupt country and everything. But thank God, for like Barbara said, for these local unions, the National Garment Workers Federation, the Bangladesh Center for Worker Solidarity, they're out there on the front lines. They're helping the workers move into schools, into any public spaces. Workers are living on highways, because sometimes the highways are elevated above the floodwaters. And it's a desperate scramble on. I mean, I think the United States is quite unique. We just got off the phone with London, talking to people there about the flood in Bangladesh, and it's front page newspaper in England. It's all over the place, and people know. So it's beginning. The aid is starting to trickle in, and here we're trying to do the same thing. We want to try to get as much money as quickly as possible to the hands of the local Bangladesh Workers Solidarity Center and the National Garment Workers Federation, because the workers turn to them for bottled water, for a little food, for a piece of clothing, for a piece of medicine, for these water purification tablets. So I think the scramble's on now to help as much as we can.
We should also backtrack. Last time, Ken and I met with a group of women whom you, Charlie, and Barbara had brought to this country to lift up the issue of their organizing efforts and their desire not to have, in this case, the Disney Corporation leave, since they would be left without jobs. Tell us more about the organizing efforts and the conditions that the women in general, even before these horrific, horrific floods, were going through as they sought to unionize, to organize themselves, to resist abusive conditions in the textile factories that they worked in.
You met Lisa and Mahamuda, and they were working for Walmart and for Disney, as you said. And typically they were working, you know, typical shifts, which are 12 to 14 hours a day. 7 in the morning till 7 or 9 or 10 at night, typically 6 or 7 days a week. And their biggest fight was just for one day off a week to rest and take care of their families, and making a starvation wage, 12 to 20 cents an hour, which, you know, already leaves them no fallback, no padding whatsoever. They're just right on the edge even to begin with.
But they're fighting. It's quite amazing. These young women have fought for their basic rights, have fought for time off to be with their family, fought to be paid their overtime correctly. But I'll tell you, there was this strike outside of Dhaka not long ago, and what the response was, the workers blocked the gate, the women blocked the gate so the shipping couldn't get out. They were asking for one day a week off, their minimum wage to be paid, overtime to be voluntary, and for them to be paid their overtime wage correctly. The response was, 6 workers were shot to death, the workers were beaten with clubs, and they tied the women together like they were cattle. They roped them all around the ankles and had them all pinned into like a corral. In other words, the bravery's there. The guts are there. And the workers might not know about the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and they might not know about the International Labor Organization and so on, the core labor standards, but they want to be treated like human beings. And they're out there every single day. But they won an enormous victory recently. They launched a campaign so that they would receive their full maternity leave with benefits. 95% of the factories in Bangladesh producing for the biggest U.S. power companies in the world were violating the law in Bangladesh, which says a woman should get 3 months maternity leave with full pay. No one paid it. Nobody. Not the biggest companies in the world. They launched a campaign in Bangladesh, and right now the government says it'll extend maternity leave with full pay to 4 months, and 19 U.S. companies have signed the pledge that from this point forward, they will guarantee that the rights of these women are respected when it comes to the maternity leave with full pay. So it's not as if it's always a loss. I mean, people are getting killed, people are getting beaten, but people are also winning.
And the corporations now, is there a demand on them to return something back to this economy, to these women, to provide them with the necessary housing, to provide them with the medicine and other necessities they need after this horrific, terrible flooding situation.
Well, it's very interesting to say that, because Barbara and I were just talking now. Of course, we wrote to the companies. We have not heard a single response. You know, we've got, a very good response from people. I mean, we only launched this thing, but no, I mean, we didn't. It's rather pathetic, but no, haven't heard from the company. They certainly owe the people something. They've been taken. There's 1.8 million garment workers in Bangladesh, and they send about 926 million garments a year to the United States. And a lot of these companies are really riding on the backs of these workers, riding on their cheap labor, their exploitation. They're being stripped of their rights. So you got these young women in Bangladesh, many of them malnutrition, actually carrying Disney on their shoulder, carrying Walmart on their shoulder. The third general, Selena, who we interviewed, who was slapped and beaten by her supervisor and paid 7 cents an hour to put together clothing for Walmart. And if she didn't make her production goal, the supervisor would slap her in the face and curse at her that she was a whore and a prostitute. And this was a kid who worked 7 days a week, worked from 7:30 in the morning until 9 or 10 o'clock at night, worked to 3 a.m. And this is how those companies have built their empires. They owe those workers.
And we are very, very pleased that you've taken up this issue and that you're spreading the news about this. And how can people help?
If people want to make a contribution to the workers for flood relief, you can do it basically through our website. Every single penny, or write a check for that matter, but every single penny that we get for the workers will go to Bangladesh and will get into the hands of the workers, and a tiny bit can make a big difference. It can help save a worker and her family. So you can go to the National Labor Committee's website and pay that way. It's www.nlcnet.org. Or be in touch with us at 212-242-3002.
And Barbara, give that number and that website again, please.
Yes, the website, and it's very, very easy to pay through the website, is www.nlcnet.org. Or you can call, write a check, call us, we'll talk about it, 212-242-3002.
Barbara Briggs, Charlie Kernighan from the National Labor Committee, thank you for being with us on Building Bridges.
With us now, we have Paul Krugman, New York Times columnist and author of The Great Unraveling, Losing Our Way in the New Century. And Paul Krugman contributes to the unraveling of Bush with this new edition of his bestseller, with new material just in time for the election debate. With an anemic jobless recovery, a mounting federal deficit, and the quagmire in Iraq, Bush has been a disaster for the U.S. and the world, and will ask Paul Krugman whether either can survive 4 more years of Bushomics and Bush's disastrous global policies. Paul Krugman, welcome to WBAI Radio.
Thanks for having me on.
Oh, a pleasure. I wanted to ask you first about the title of your book, The Great Unraveling. Why the word unraveling?
Well, when I wrote it, and even more so now, I think that a lot of things are coming apart. Obviously, it's partly the economics, but more than that, it's a real unraveling of American politics as we know it. And it was kind of a despairing thing at the time I chose the title, because I really felt that, my God, we're really losing it. Now I have some hopes that it might turn around, but it's, you know, think about where we thought we were in 2000 and what it feels like now with the U.S. economy in trouble, with the U.S. Army bogged down in what looks, you know, can we call it a quagmire yet in Iraq? Just all together, we seem to have really, we lost it. And we hope this doesn't continue.
Let's talk first about the economy, and let's talk a little bit about Bush's tax cuts and the debt, I think two of your favorite topics. How do those interrelate, and how do they relate to the unraveling?
The economy is, now let's, I think you make a mistake to count on every month's job numbers being as bad as the last ones we saw. I wouldn't be surprised if we've got a 100,000, 150,000 jobs next month. The point is, here we are. This is the worst job record since Herbert Hoover. You don't have to stretch to say that. And we had a really disastrous deterioration in the job situation between early 2001 and last summer. And since then, it's not much better. and it's a really rotten economy. The big thing is the contrast. Here we had all these tax cuts, enormous amounts of money, very heavily concentrated on the wealthy, which were supposed to yield wonderful returns, and what we've got is very, you know, hardly anything. Trickle down didn't trickle down, and that's the story.
Well, what could have been done? What would you have done differently?
Well, there's a whole list of things that are actually sort of standard practice. The most important thing is when you've got this kind of depressed economy, you want to give money to people who will spend it, and also preferably to people who need it. So what we should have had was first extended unemployment insurance. They let that lapse at the end of 2002, not because things were actually any better, but because they wanted to pretend that things were getting better. We should have had rebates to lower and middle income people who are cash strapped and likely to actually spend the money. We should have had aid to state and local governments so you weren't laying off school teachers and firemen in the middle of a recession. And we should have had public spending, you know, port security. Everybody says there are billions of dollars of needed spending there, which would also have created jobs. None of that happened. Instead, you've got this tax cut for the rich, which puts money into the hands of people who are probably not going to spend it. It's on the list of things you can do, this has got the least bang for the buck.
You call President Bush a radical or revolutionary. What do you mean by that?
Well, if conservative means anything, it means you want to turn the clock back a little bit, but it doesn't mean that you want to turn our society into something it hasn't been in living memory and maybe ever. But if you look at the thrust of where they're going, first of all, in domestic policy, they're really trying to unravel all the financial basis, the fiscal basis for the welfare state, get rid of the fiscal basis for Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, privatize Social Security. That's, you know, we haven't been without a publicly funded Social Security system since before Franklin Roosevelt. They've been rolling back environmental regulations, and they've been pursuing a force-based, aggressive foreign policy, which is completely alien to the American tradition. So I call this radicalism.
How is it different from what his father, that's Bush Sr., and Ronald Reagan did? They did a lot of the same things and also inflated the federal deficit so that Stockman said wouldn't be able to spend on social programs.
Well, what Reagan, there was some of that. I mean, in some ways, Reagan was a foreshadowing. But Reagan, first of all, Reagan didn't lie to the same degree. I mean, Reagan said, here I have these tax cuts, and through the magic of supply-side economics, they'll pay for themselves. Which might have been silly, but he didn't say, here are these tax cuts, and even though they look like they're for rich people, they're really for the middle class, which is what Bush has pretended. The other thing is that Reagan was willing to some degree at least see reason. When the tax cuts didn't produce the desired effect, and when the deficit really ballooned, he was willing to accept at least a partway rollback. When the same thing happened to Bush, he said, let's have another round of tax cuts, in some ways even more tilted towards the very wealthy. Bush one was on foreign policy a reasonable guy. That is, whatever else you might say, if you want the best explanation of why it was a really bad idea to occupy Iraq, you read Bush's father's essay on that, in which he warned, or he said that we didn't go to Baghdad in 91 because we would have found ourselves an occupying power in a bitterly hostile land.
I seem to remember a lot of activity in Central America, though. Under Bush and under Reagan, which didn't make him, to my mind at least, very reasonable.
Well, I mean, there's degrees and degrees. You know, I obviously, this Bush, too, didn't spring out of nowhere. And a lot of the really bad stuff that's going on is the Iran-Contra guys never went away. I think Bill Clinton's biggest mistake was not to have a witch hunt. And I earnestly hope that if Kerry comes in, we will have a naming and shaming, at least, of the people who are responsible for the terrible things that have been happening these past 3.5 years.
I certainly hope so, but I don't really understand what Kerry is saying half of the time. I don't understand his explanation of the vote. And I don't understand his economic policies either with regard to further tax cuts.
Kerry's economics is really pretty clear. Deficit hawks won't be happy. He's not making a big emphasis on deficits. If you want to complain, you can say there isn't enough deficit reduction in there. But he says, let's roll back the tax cuts for top end and use the money primarily for health care extending health insurance to a lot of people who don't now have it and reducing the cost for most other people. And that's clear cut. The numbers work. If you're more aggressive, I'd like more than he's offering, but big step in the right direction. No problem there.
And his position on Iraq, how he explained his vote?
His position on Iraq is, we can talk about this a little bit. And I think he should be really clear. What he really should say is, knowing this president, he should not have had the authority to go to war. But he hasn't been quite willing to say that. But I would say if I was a politician trying to win a national election, and that, after all, is what this is about, you have a real problem talking about Iraq because the general public doesn't understand just how bad it is. They don't understand how thoroughly chained up the situation is. And so a realistic discussion of Iraq is going to sound to a lot of people like defeatism. Bush is going to say, I want to stay the course. My opponent wants to cut and run. And so I think we've got to – I understand, though I don't totally approve of Kerry's caution on all that.
What do you believe to be – I mean, what is your position with regard – what is the realistic position?
My position is we now find the least bad guy in Iraq and hand over the keys as quickly as possible. We're quickly running out of options. I mean, by January – there may be nobody to hand the keys over to, and I don't know what we do then, but I think we have, it is possible for really bad leadership to leave you with no good options, and I'm afraid that's what's been happening with Bush.
Do you think we should withdraw now?
You don't want to announce a date certain for withdrawal, because there's still a possibility that you can find some people, some probably Shiite clerics, that you can sort of hand over power to in a way that's reasonable. You don't want to say, well, we're out of here in 3 months, so goodbye. That just encourages everybody. But I do not want to see U.S. troops there 18 months from now. I just don't think this is going to – we are – the longer we stay, we should be preparing for our exit, not announcing a day and a time, but we should be preparing for the exit pretty soon.
And is Alawi that guy?
I think we made a big mistake with Alawi. I think we got somebody who is a kind of a tough guy, more than a bit of a thug, but without a constituency. I think if we can still do something with Sistani, that's where we want to go. You know, this is moving rapidly. For all we know, we'll wake up tomorrow morning, the news that somebody, us or maybe the people inside, have blown up the shrine in Najaf. And at that point, I think the game is up.
I mean, when I look at it and I think of all of the different governments that we propped up and were destroyed and we recreated in Vietnam in the 60s, it just seems to me, when I used the word quagmire before, we're there.
Well, we're pretty close. I mean, it's just in the last 6 weeks things have gotten a lot worse. Actually, just in the last 2 weeks things have gotten a lot worse. So, but you know, let me say this about the presidential campaign: this is not Kerry's job, right? He doesn't have to say that he has a great answer in Iraq. It's the guy who's in the White House now who has arranged that there are no good answers.
And given your views with regard to the radicalism, revolutionariness of George Bush, where do you think he'll go if he got a second term?
I shudder to think. I really don't want to know. The thing is, aside from the radicalism, the other thing that these people have shown is that they've got a sort of reverse Midas touch when it comes to any actual business of governing. Everything they touch turns to crud. And so what we get is that over and over again, the economy, the budget, the environment, Iraq, they make a mess. God knows. I mean, I foresee more disastrous foreign ventures, probably a financial crisis when investors around the world realize that America really has turned into a banana republic.
When you say a banana republic, I can't help but pursue that. If any other country in the world were pursuing the policies that we're pursuing with regard to the debt, trade deficit, I mean, wouldn't the IMF have come in by now? I mean, that we have this reserve currency?
No, not really. That's not really crucial. First world countries get a lot of benefit of the doubt. There was a time when Belgium looked like it was really hopeless, and the market sort of said, well, you know, it's a rich country, they can probably, and a politically stable country, they can probably fix it, and they did. The thing that makes it, and we had these budget deficits on, but we had a reasonable chance of mature, grown-up political leadership. We would get a number of years of grace to get the thing under control. But if the markets sort of say, you know, these people are completely unrealistic. Here we are, big deficits, and they're pushing for more tax cuts and more wars, and then they'll pull the plug. So I've seen advanced countries that had numbers even worse than ours not have a crisis, but they were also countries where you actually did have adults minding the store, and we do not.
And I can't help but ask, I know your column comes out on probably interrupting your working on it.
Voting. I'm last chance to do something so that we don't have, I think we have a high risk, I'd say about one chance in four, of a suspect election. Not one that's necessarily stolen, as you may never know, but one that a lot of people suspect was stolen, which I think will just be just catastrophic. So I have a list of suggestions of things that we can do to minimize that risk.
You think
coming out in tomorrow's paper.
Do you think we should contract it out to the Venezuelans?
Well, you know, it's you know, I hate to, maybe this will get me in big trouble. The people who do this right, it's too late to do this for this election, are actually the French. They have paper ballots, and when the votes are counted, their system is that you have as many people of as many political views as possible in the room watching. That's how you should do it. The vote is a sacred thing, and I can believe, but I'm horrified to think that my country is heading towards a real possibility that we will not have an election that people trust.
I'm sorry, we lost it for a second. Who did you say got it right?
The French. Yeah,
okay,
the French are doing democracy a lot more seriously than we are these days.
Okay, in the closing moments, why should people go out tomorrow, maybe even tonight, and buy the new edition of your book, The Great Unraveling?
My publisher wants to say is there's 100 pages of new material, 29 new columns. Really, what I've added to the old edition is a discussion of what's happened in this past year. And I like to think that I'm telling the story of our times and giving people some idea of what you can try and do about it. It's a really important, you know, I don't want to say you'll buy my book. There are many excellent books.
I'll say it. It's a great read. I mean, it brings together a lot of, when you read the columns like once a week or twice a week, you don't always get the full impact of seeing them side by side. And I think it really does give it's the depressing history of the last few years, but it's a necessary
history.
The arc
of what's happened is really horrifying. I mean, when I read them over, I think to myself, my God, how could things have gone downhill so fast so far?
Well, hopefully you'll be able to write some good columns in the next few years that won't be so depressing, but everybody's got to go out there and vote and turn the bad guys out. And I don't know if there are any good guys, but give them a chance.
Well, there's less bad guys.
Okay.
Yeah, throw the bums out. Okay.
Okay, the dismal science. Thank you so much for being on Building Bridges. We've been talking with Paul Krugman, columnist for The New York Times and author of The Great Unraveling.
You've been listening to Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. And to find out more about Building Bridges, you can go to our website at www.buildingbridgesonline.org.